Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is A20-0558, State of Minnesota versus Ezekiel John Miller. We are hearing this case on the Zoom platform today in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. The procedural rules that apply to Zoom oral arguments are the same as those that apply to in-person oral arguments. So I think you know each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal is keeping time on a screen, which you can see in your grid view. If there's any issues with the technology during this hearing, he will stop the time and we'll make sure you're accorded your full allotted time. The oral argument is being recorded today. Any other recording is not permitted except by the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So counsel, for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. Please introduce yourself and the party you represent when you begin your argument. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Laura Heinrich and I represent the appellant, Ezekiel Miller. There are two pretrial constitutional rulings that are on appeal in this case. The first is whether police officers unlawfully seized Mr. Miller. The second is whether the eyewitness identifications were reliable and therefore admissible at trial. Mr. Miller's conviction must be vacated if the district court erred on the first ruling. This court would not have to address the second ruling. It's a little unclear from the stipulation between the parties at the district court, both in the submitted stipulation as well as what was on the record in the November 19th, 2019 hearing, if the court were not to decide that the court erred, this court were not to decide if the court erred on the first ruling, whether or not a finding that the court's ruling on the second issue alone would be enough to be dispositive of the case. Our contention is that it would be because both rulings would mean that the eyewitness identifications would not come in. First, this court must determine for the first issue as to whether Mr. Miller was seized and then whether there was reasonable articulable suspicion to do so. The district court's ruling was that Mr. Miller was not seized. It's a little unclear from whether the state is conceding that he was seized or not. The state seems to be conceding that there was not reasonable articulable suspicion to do so. This court looks at first, if a person is seized, whether or not a reasonable person would feel that they had the ability to walk away from the encounter with the police officers. Here, and that's if they're not physically actually seized, it's sort of looking at a number of circumstances. Here, the court doesn't really need to engage as whether or not this person would have believed they could have walked away, Mr. Miller, because police officers actually told him he couldn't. He asked to leave multiple times. Police officers said, no, you're not allowed to leave. Police officers then said Mr. Miller had to come with them because they were going to do show up identifications. And when Mr. Miller asked if the people could be brought to the parking lot, they said, no, we've got to bring them to you. So three times they let him know that he wasn't allowed to leave and that he had to not only stay, but he had to actually get into the car and leave with them. Under those circumstances, a person is clearly seized. They did not have the ability to walk away. And everybody concedes, even the police officers, that they did not have reasonable articulable suspicion to hold him, which is a minimum standard under the Constitution to seize somebody. I see that Judge Gaetis, you've raised your hand.
Yes, Ms. Heinrich. So I say we agree with you on the first issue that Mr. Miller was seized. Is our only option to then go to the Terry standard of reasonable and articulable suspicion, or does this court have other options in your view for analyzing the reasonableness of the seizure?
Judge, there is no other standard. The Constitution contemplates in the language of the Constitution probable cause before somebody is seized. There's a line of cases as the court has identified and is discussed in both briefs that if you have less than probable cause but enough reasonable articulable suspicion, you can seize somebody. There is no other line of cases. There's no other squishy standard of reasonableness that police officers can take action. The state in their brief I'm a little confused. The hand is still up for Judge Gaetis, and I'm not sure if that means you have another question or if I should continue.
I have lots of questions, but I'm going to put my hand down, and it looks like Judge Larkin has a question.
Okay.
I do. Thank you. I'm a little confused by your statement that there is no other standard. I've read, in preparation for this case, treaties, federal cases, cases from other state appellate courts, in which courts have sort of consistently said the Constitution allows seizure of a witness to a crime or a victim of a crime if there are exigent circumstances justifying the seizure. And so long as the seizure is no longer than necessary or no more intrusive than is necessary. And those cases seem to say that if you've got a violent crime, which has just occurred, and the police reasonably determine that someone is a victim or a witness of that crime, and the police reasonably believe that they need to detain that person temporarily to sort of freeze the situation, find the perpetrator, that doesn't offend the Constitution. Are you familiar with that case law, and can you discuss it at all today? It seems to say you can have a seizure of a victim or a witness to a crime if there are exigent circumstances, and exigent circumstances would include recent commission of a violent crime, suspect is at large. And then once you have the seizure, it should be no longer than is necessary to obtain the purpose of the seizure, which is, you know, to get the information needed to find the suspect, freeze the scene, et cetera.
I'm familiar with the case law in Minnesota that was cited in my brief, like State v. Chappelle, which is a case where police officers were stopping somebody who was a witness in a crime because they wanted to bring him in for questioning regarding sort of the relationship between individuals and some DNA on a lamp switch with a homicide case. In that case, while it is unpublished, it is Minnesota and under the Minnesota Constitution, this court found that the police officer still needed the minimum reasonable articulable suspicion, even though this individual was just a witness. It didn't seem to suggest that there was an exception under the Minnesota Constitution to a lower standard or a different type of standard if this person is a victim or a witness. I would also point out, would you like me to finish or did you want
finish.
To?
I'm sorry.
Okay. I would also point out that the state seems to be making that same argument and pointing to Minnesota cases, State v. Wald and State v. Applegate in its brief. Both of those cases address circumstances that are similar to the scenarios that you just brought up, which is that you have information about a crime that's just committed and they want to be able to stop people because they're not sure there's suspects at large, there's a gun. And both of those cases point out five different factors for the court to look at to determine whether or not police officers had reasonable articulable suspicion. They don't actually point to a different standard. They just provide different criteria for the court to look at as to whether or not these officers had established reasonable articulable suspicion. So I think all of the Minnesota cases that deal with situations that are similar to what you're bringing up in terms of federal case law all still point this court to review whether or not police officers had reasonable articulable suspicion, not a different standard.
Well, I say a different standard because the cases I am looking at obviously are dealing with Fourth Amendment. And I don't know if you're making an argument that regardless of where we would come down under Fourth Amendment analysis, we should interpret the Minnesota Constitution more broadly and differently. And, you know, those cases do talk about, okay, we're applying the Terry construct to the situation involving victims and witnesses, but they don't say you have to suspect somebody is obviously committed a crime to detain them as a victim or a witness. And you're not making that argument, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, my question is this. I mean, yes, Terry applies here, but it doesn't apply to the extent that we would say, well, unless you had some suspicion that the person seized was involved in a crime as a perpetrator, you can't seize them. I mean, the federal cases seem to say that the Terry reasoning allowing a brief investigatory seizure is applicable to victims and witnesses. Do you agree that that's what the federal case law says?
Your Honor, I would feel as though any answer I had to this would not be well informed. I'm not as familiar with this case law. And I would just point out, when it comes to Article 1, Section 10 analysis, from EDJ to Asher to Ask Ruth forward, the Minnesota Constitution has consistently been more protective. So I'm not arguing that there's like a different standard that would ultimately evolve here, that I'm asking for a more protective standard. The more protective standard has already been established through that line of cases.
Yes, but that line of cases is case specific. You know, under this circumstance, do we want to interpret the Minnesota Constitution more broadly? Just because the Supreme Court has interpreted the Minnesota Constitution as providing greater rights in certain circumstances than the Fourth Amendment, doesn't mean that for all Fourth Amendment issues, the Minnesota Constitution will be interpreted more broadly. It's a case by case basis. And frankly, it's generally done by the Minnesota Supreme Court. But it sounds like we don't have any direct authority in Minnesota concerning the detention of a purported crime victim, because again, he wasn't picked off the street as a random person who might have seen a crime. He, you know, maybe he himself did not initiate contact with the police, but he went into a public place and claimed to be a crime victim and the police were called. So in my view, that makes us a little different than situations where the police are sort of freezing a situation and anyone who is nearby a crime who might happen to know something. But, and that goes more to the federal case law, but I'll let you continue.
It would appear that Judge Cochran has a question.
Yeah, Ms. Heinrich, just a quick follow-up. Assuming an exigency could support the detention of a crime victim for a limited purpose, is the exigency here sufficient to support the length of time that appellant was detained, the 30 minutes?
Well, I guess I sort of take issue with the use of the word exigency, just because it has such a specific understanding with the case law regarding sort of exigent circumstances where police officers freeze a scene or have probable cause and are in the process of getting a search warrant. But I do understand your question to mean that even if there were some legal authority to hold Mr. Miller for a period of time as the victim of a crime to try to conduct their investigation, I would say no, that the amount of time and the fact that they physically transported him someplace else wouldn't be reasonable even under exigent circumstances in the way this court seems to be talking about it. They had his contact information. He had a phone number that worked. They had a local address. He explained that he'd be willing to work with them later on, that he had a music session he had to get to for his job, and that he needed to be able to show up for that appointment because it's very hard to get studio time and he didn't have a lot of resources. I see Judge Larkin has a hand up.
And those are all factors, but we always, for the Fourth Amendment, look at the totality of the circumstances. The other circumstances are the police were aware that there had been an armed robbery with a gun in the area. It was nearby. They were investigating it. The suspect was at large. And Mr. Miller made statements to the police that reasonably led them to believe that this armed robber who was at large had tackled him or attempted to rob him, and that he could identify this person. So those seem to be the sort of exigencies discussed in the federal case law when determining whether it's appropriate to detain a victim or a witness in those circumstances. Don't you think those facts would be reasonable as well? I mean, the idea is, okay, yes, you had his contact information, you could set up a statement later, but at that point in time, the police were concerned with apprehending someone who had just attempted a robbery with a gun who was at large in the community, and your client told police that he was a victim of that person and that he could identify the person. Doesn't that sort of tip the reasonableness determination to a conclusion that it was okay to continue to hold on to your client for 30 minutes while they did a show up, especially where he wasn't handcuffed, he wasn't searched, there were no other infringements on his movement other than taking him to do a show up.
I mean, ultimately, yeah. That would mean that a person who was suspected of committing a crime would have more constitutional protections than a person who is a witness to a crime or a victim to a crime. That his freedom of movement, his day, would be able to be interfered with reasonably versus somebody who was being accused of a crime if they didn't have reasonable articulable suspicion, which they don't hear for Mr. Miller, would be able to walk away or to have his evidence suppressed. I think this
when
actually-
When you say they don't have reasonable articulable suspicion with regard to Mr. Miller, are you arguing they had no reason to believe he was engaged in criminal conduct or had committed a crime?
Correct.
Okay, so then that's where we disagree, and we'll have to leave it at that, because the federal case law is clear that that standard or that showing is not applicable when you're considering a detention of a victim or witness to a crime.
And not to sound like a broken record, but I would just point again to Chappelle, the unpublished case in Minnesota that's dealing with the witness, where this court said you still need to have reasonable articulable suspicion if you're going to stop that person. And this is not a situation that's going to happen often. I mean,
right,
it's ultimately.
It's an unpublished case. It's not precedential. We're not bound by it. And this seems to be a huge issue, which has not been decided in Minnesota. That is the detention of a purported crime victim for investigative purposes while an armed suspect is at large. And there is federal case law that's on point. And so we have to look at that case law. We can't decide the case based on one unpublished opinion of the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
I see that my time has elapsed. And I would reserve.
Judge Cochran, may I ask a question,
please?
Thank you. So I have a question, Ms. Heinrich, before you wrap up here about the record in this case. Does the record show that the officers who were with the victims in the case, the victims at the gas station, were they with those victims at the time that the officers who were driving around with Mr. Miller were engaging in that activity, the driving around?
So we have said the record is a number of different squad car videos as well as bodywear camera videos, and it would appear that they have the two complaining witnesses or victims of the robbery in the backseat of Officer LeFung's squad car at the same time or similar in time to when the police officers are speaking to Mr. Miller at the at Elsa's house of sleep in the parking lot. And then ultimately he's in the back of their squad car. So the timing isn't very off between those two. I think that's what Your Honor is asking.
I am, thank you.
Any further questions from the panel? Okay, thank you, Ms. Heinrich. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. I do intend today to focus on the question of whether there was an illegal seizure here, but there are two things I'd like to very briefly discuss first. I want to start by conceding that appellant's right. Harmless error analysis does not apply to a stipulated evidence trial under Rule 2601 of Subdivision 4. The problem here is we don't have a proper stipulated evidence trial under Rule 2601, Subdivision 4, because under Parts C and G of that rule, the prosecutor has to personally acknowledge in writing on the record that the pretrial issue is dispositive. And that didn't happen here. I see a question. Judge, you're on mute, I'm sorry.
Sure am, thank you. Do you agree or disagree that the intent of the parties was to proceed under Subdivision 4 of 2601?
It was, Your Honor. So the thing I was going to say just next was, now, I'm not saying you should apply harmless error analysis here, because if you did, appellant would have a slam dunk argument on post-conviction for ineffective assistance of counsel or for his waiver of jury trial not being knowing and intelligent. My point here is just going to remedy that if you reverse Judge Gruing here, you should not order this case dismissed. Now, appellant hasn't asked you to do that. The RJE decision didn't do that. But my point is just that when this goes back, appellant will have to decide, with the evidence remaining, Does he want a bench trial? Does he want a jury trial? Does he want to work a deal? The state never agreed here that it couldn't go forward without this evidence. That was purely on the defense side.
Well, here's the problem with that argument as I see it. 2601 sub 4 is very specific about what is supposed to happen for a trial in which a defendant stipulates to the prosecution's case to obtain a pretrial ruling. I chaired the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure when this rule was written, and quite frankly, I wrote it. And we did so at the urging of the Supreme Court because they wanted a clear rule that put everyone on notice exactly how this was going to work if you agreed to it. So my question for you is, if you didn't do what was necessary to have a trial under this rule, why wouldn't we just reverse and say, go back to square one? Either you're bound by the agreement or we're starting over. What you seem to be asking for, which is, well, we'll just go back and have a trial with remaining evidence, defeats the whole purpose of the rule.
Well, Your Honor, I think going back to square one would mean that everyone can just go forward with the case, given the fact that some evidence had been suppressed. I mean, just like if the evidence had been suppressed in the first place, the state would then have had to decide, are we going to dismiss the case? Are we going to go try and get some more evidence? Do we think we can go forward even without this evidence? So my only point here is that because the prosecutor never agreed that without this evidence, we couldn't go forward, the case shouldn't just be dismissed by this court. I mean, that's something the parties can argue about if there's a remand here, but this isn't a sort of double jeopardy situation where there's no possibility of going forward. So I'm really just withdrawing my argument that you should apply harmless error analysis here, but pointing out that the problem is, and I've looked at the waiver of the jury trial, I've looked at the record, there was never any agreement with the prosecutor that the state couldn't go forward without this evidence. It was just the defense saying, yeah, without this evidence, there's no point in us having a jury trial.
So there is no, I note that the rules have appended to them a form which is recommended to be used in these circumstances where everybody will execute the necessary waivers and agreements. That form wasn't used here?
No, Your Honor. I have in front of me the waiver of jury trial pursuant to Subdivision 4 form, and it's only signed by the defendant and his attorney. It's not signed by the prosecutor, and there's nothing on the record where the prosecutor says, yeah, without this evidence, we're sunk. I mean, the prosecutor wouldn't have agreed to that because we have a videotape of him committing this crime. So this case was just not handled properly at the district court level, and all that—
No, it wasn't. Why was the prosecutor agreeing on the record to a proceeding under 2601 sub 4 if he had no intent to be bound by the decision as dispositive?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think—
Understood.
I think everyone just thought the defense was saying, hey, if this evidence can't come in, if this doesn't comes in, then we don't need a trial. We'll just go forward. And it was to preserve that because the defense didn't see any point in going forward with this. There just wasn't any meeting of the minds in terms of the state's remaining evidence. So that was just the first point. The other thing I just wanted to say quickly was, like appellant, I don't intend to address the show up identification issue this morning unless this court has questions because it's straightforward. It isn't addressed in the reply brief. I'll just turn the remainder of my time to the question of whether there was an illegal seizure here. And just to be clear, as I said, I think pretty clearly in my brief, I am not arguing that there was reasonable articulable suspicion for a seizure here. Clearly the police thought this involved a crime victim, not someone who had committed a crime. And I'm not taking a position on whether Judge Gruing erred in finding that there wasn't a seizure here because you don't need to reach that. Even if there was a seizure here, it was reasonable. And that's the touchstone under the Fourth Amendment, under the combination of two unique facts. And I think those two facts are what make this different from any case that I've ever found. The first fact is that appellant himself reported being the victim of an armed robbery. So he took an affirmative step here to involve the police. He wasn't just somebody on the street who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He took an affirmative step here. And you have to consider that in conjunction with the second key fact, which is that appellant reported a very serious crime, a brazen robbery in the middle of the day, in the middle of a densely populated area. He said he could identify the robbers. The police reasonably believed these were the same robbers who had just committed a brazen armed robbery in roughly the same place at roughly the same time. The police had suspects in custody right then and there, but they hadn't recovered the gun. So the police needed to know, are we holding the wrong people? Do we need to expand our manhunt because there's still an armed robber out there who's already robbed two people? That's why there was an exigent circumstance here, which just means there was an emergency that allows the police to do something the Fourth Amendment won't normally allow. And I'll pause for a question, sorry.
Mr. Ricketts, given that the crime victims, I believe their initials are MV and MB, were in the back of another police vehicle, was it truly an exigent circumstance that required detention in this case with regard to this individual in terms of identifying potential suspects?
My argument, Your Honor, is that it was, because this was sort of a chaotic scene. The victims described being robbed at a gas station by three people and then a gang of youths or juveniles robbing them some more. And it's not clear how all these groups are related. It's not clear how many people were involved. So the police needed to know, do we have everyone who's committing armed robberies in the middle of the day in St. Paul? Or do we only have one of the groups and the other group is still out there maybe doing this to somebody else? And I think the other important thing to factor in here, which has already been discussed a little bit, is the police didn't detain appellant for a long period of time. It was less than 30 minutes. And at the end, they were giving him a ride home when they discovered this CCTV video that showed he was himself an armed robber. So it isn't a great deal of time. They never touched him. You can see on the videos, they were very friendly with him. They didn't search him. They let him plug in his phone. They were talking to his friend about his anxiety. Sorry, Judge Gaitis.
Thanks. So in looking at what happened in the district court, it appears to me that the state put all of its eggs in the no seizure basket. And given that it was the state's burden to establish that this was not unconstitutional activity on the part of the police, have you guys simply waived any argument that there was some other justification here that would make the seizure okay if this court were to find that there was a seizure?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, appellant hasn't made any sort of waiver forfeiture argument here. So that hasn't been put before the court. And more importantly, under Grunig, a respondent can make an alternative argument as long as, you know, the facts support it, as long as it isn't the sort of argument where you need to develop the record further. And no one's arguing about the facts here. The facts are all largely on video. So the facts are well set. And appellant has never argued we'd need new facts or more facts to analyze my reasonableness argument. So there just simply isn't any argument before this court that is a new argument that this court can't consider that has been forfeited.
And just so that I'm clear about, I'll take my hand down, just so that I'm clear about what your position is now, is it your argument that there was a seizure, or is it your argument that there was no seizure?
My argument is that you don't need to decide whether there was a seizure, because even if there was, it was reasonable under these two unique facts I've discussed and under the case law that talks about the ultimate test being reasonableness. So Judge Gruing found that there wasn't a seizure here. And I'm not taking any position on that. I mean, it's a thorough ruling. The facts are what they are. My argument is simply that it doesn't matter whether there was a seizure here because of these two unique facts that made what happened here reasonable.
Mr. Ricketts, what case do you think we should look to determine whether this was reasonable? What case do you think is most analogous?
Your Honor, I think you should look at the cases that Judge Larkin found, because she did a better job than I did. I didn't find any cases that dealt with facts that were close to these. And of course, that cuts both ways. There's no case law that says police can't do this. I didn't find any case law that says under unique facts like these, the police still can't do this. I mean, I think that is the key thing here, is that you have someone who affirmatively involved the police. It isn't just someone on the street, and you have an emergency situation in the middle of the day with an armed robber. So I'm relying on the general principle that what the Fourth Amendment requires is reasonableness, and under the principle that exigent circumstances can make it reasonable to do things the Fourth Amendment wouldn't otherwise allow. But it's a case-by-case basis. If they had seized appellant for 2 hours, I would have a much harder argument. But this is, again, is less than 30 minutes, and part of those 30 minutes are giving him a ride home.
So just to interrupt, if they had seized him for 2 hours, would your rule be the same, that the court just sort of willy-nilly applies a reasonableness standard without any other sort of rule?
I think the court would have to look at all of the circumstances to determine if it's reasonable. I mean, if the situation involved a mass shooting with a gunman with a machine gun still at large, well, then maybe 2 hours wouldn't be reasonable. I think you always have to look at the facts under these cases. And I think it's also an important fact here that the police were really nice to appellant. I mean, he didn't want to get out of the car. They didn't make him get out of the car. They charged his phone for him. They were trying to move this along as quickly as they possibly could and do everything.
Are you suggesting that we should look at how nice the police are? I mean, I have some concerns about that and about whether a court should be assessing the niceness of officers when really ultimately we have to be considering the Constitution.
Well, but I think it goes to reasonableness. If they had handcuffed him and treated him roughly and basically just made him wait around while they went and got coffee or did something else, that might not be reasonable. But here they did everything they could shy of saying, well, we're just gonna let you go. You know, even though there's some armed robbers potentially at large, they did everything shy of that to accommodate him and to move things along as quickly as they possibly could. And again, we're under a half an hour here. They were giving him a ride home. They charged his phone for him. This was reasonable in light of the very serious circumstance that they faced. That's ultimately my argument. And looking at my notes quickly, I don't think there's anything else I wanted to say in response to appellant's argument. So unless there are additional questions, I simply ask that you affirm you affirm Judge Gruing's ruling to the extent that you affirm that this evidence did not need to be dismissed or suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal, Ms. Heinrich?
Thank you. I did want to try to respond to some of the discussion about freezing the scene under these particular circumstances where you have a robbery at large, they're in the middle of an investigation, what would be reasonable? Ultimately, there is some case law in Minnesota about, you know, if there's a report of a robbery, somebody is at large, what are police meant to do? They can scour the neighborhood, they can detain people to do investigation within sort of to use the sort of general concept that seems to be talked about here today, is that that's reasonable with the facts that they have. Here, it's slightly different in that they're not freezing the scene or detaining a person on the scene while they're continuing to investigation, such as if they're executing a search warrant and there are people at the home, or if they're stopping somebody in a car who's nearby where a robbery or burglary was committed. They're actually taking Mr. Miller, putting him in a car and moving him, which I think is a fact that makes this different. They're not freezing the scene. They're ultimately conscripting him to come with for 27 minutes in the back of a squad car to then stay with him while he conducts his investigation. I see Judge Larkin, your hand is up.
And I agree with you on that point. I don't find the freezing the scene cases very useful because I think those involve different fact patterns. But this other line of cases I've discussed include situations where, for example, a 911 call was made regarding a domestic assault. The police get to the home. They take the 911 caller, who's a purported victim, into one car and the abuser into another. She ends up claiming, because she didn't want to cooperate with the police, that she was illegally seized. And they didn't talk about, you know, freezing the scene. They talked about, well, were there exigencies that justified a temporary detention such that this was a reasonable step by the police? And I think, you know, they just sort of looked at all the circumstances. If they just let her go without doing any investigation and without finding if there had been a domestic, she'd be going back into the home with the person who she had just said assaulted her. I mean, they look at it differently. They look at it in terms of reasonableness. What's the government interest justifying the seizure? And that seems to be where the exigent circumstances come in. balanced against the intrusion on individual rights. And that seems to be where they look at how long was the person held? Was the person handcuffed? How did they treat the person? Intensity and scope, those factors that we typically think of when we do Fourth Amendment analysis. So, you know, I agree with you that the freezing the scene cases are not very helpful, but there are cases that are more on point. For example, the one I just described.
The only thing I would point out in response is there does seem to be, at least in the way you're talking about it, Judge Larkin, there seems to be an emphasis on this idea that a victim has called the police and asked the police to come to engage with them. And that is noted also in the order from Judge Gerwig. But what she pointed out in footnote 2, and was similarly confusing to me on page 3 of her facts, is that the 911 call was not actually submitted as evidence at this hearing. The complaint talked about an individual at Elsa's house of sleep calling, not Mr. Miller. So I don't know that we have in the record in front of us a definitive answer if Mr. Miller is actually asking for help or if somebody else called on his behalf.
Does the record show, I mean, isn't it undisputed that he went into a public business and said, help me, I've been the victim of an armed robbery? And isn't the only, you know, reasonable thing that would happen after such a claim is that somebody's going to pick up the phone and call 911? I mean, I agree with you. There's nothing in the record that says he calls 911, but it seems the record shows that he engaged in behavior that inevitably would result in a 911 call and would reasonably be construed as a request for help from the police by whoever heard his declaration in the store.
Judge Larkin, I just don't think the record is as clear as that would be the inevitable thing that happened, in part because you have the actual recording from the officers who entered Elsa's house asleep. At that point, they asked the clerks if there's the person who was talking about being robbed here. He points them in that direction. Mr. Miller is on the phone with his uncle, having already ordered an Uber, telling them he's about to go. It's not clear that he had asked anybody to call. It's not clear if he just overheard or if he was just sort of ranting. He's on the phone making plans to leave. And in fact, there is an Uber in the parking lot at the point that police officers following him out.
Sounds like the domestic assault case I mentioned, where when the police get to the home and the 911 caller who claimed to have been the victim is like, I don't want anything to do with the police. I don't want to cooperate. So maybe I don't know if it hinges on who made the call as opposed to looking at what the police did and assessing whether or not it was reasonable.
And I see that I am out of time. It doesn't appear that was a question, but I can comment if you are asking for me to respond. Otherwise, I would just note that while the focus today has been on the first issue, both issues would require that Mr. Miller's convictions should be vacated. And both issues are well laid out in the briefs if they were not addressed here today.
Thank you, counsel, for your helpful arguments. We will look very closely at this important case, and the case is submitted.